Actually, I'm not in the habit of presenting cartoons in my talks, but I think this particular cartoon, which is one of my favorite, is very appropriate. Please do forgive my ignorance in mathematics, and there may be a place in my talk where you may be tempted to ask me how certain things were done, and I probably would not know. I am a scientist at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, a few miles away from here. And my main interest in research is angiogenesis. And I particularly am interested in wound angiogenesis, and I came to this field by really wanting to study angiogenesis, not really wanting to study wound healing. However, the angiogenic process of wound healing is not very well studied. Surprisingly, there is a lot more done about fibroblasts pulling collagen and things like that than than there is about revascularizing the tissue so that it regenerates. And wound healing is actually a very good model to study angiogenesis, because during wound healing, all the events that lead into the vessel formation and then into the vessel reabsorption occur within a relatively short period of time. And if you have a good model, a good animal model where to study, you can actually look at the entire span of the process of regeneration as it pertains to to blood vessel formation. So in the skin, the vessels that feed the skin are actually very interesting. There are arteries, the perforating arterioles, which are very important, because one single arteriole will supply the blood for a certain area of a few square centimeters of the skin, and this is of importance to some of the plastic surgeons, especially the more academic kind of reconstructive people, because they go and look for the arterioles so that they know, for example, in a breast reconstruction, they know how much tissue to take so that they bring it with its own arteriole, and it will fit. They can calculate how much tissue per arteriole that they find with a little Doppler. I don't think everybody does that, but so this arteriole, and that's what's called an angiosome. It's the area supplied with blood by a perforating arteriole. And the vessels in the skin are actually very abundant in the dermis, which is the vascular part of the skin. As you heard before, the epidermis is an epithelium, and it's not vascularized. It actually is separated from the dermis by a basement membrane, and that basement membrane is actually known to be a reservoir of anti-angiogenic factors. So the epidermis does not want vessels to go in, and so the vessels need to be in close contact to the epidermis, but they actually do not invade the epidermis. And there are, of course, ways of when an arteriole fails, or because it's severed or whatever, there are horizontal plexuses that actually can rapidly supply an area of the skin with blood if need be.
And how large typically is this angiosome?
There is an actual relationship between the diameter of the arteriole and the area, and I really don't know. I know that each arteriole that they look for example, in the skin of the abdomen, I think it's 5 or 7 square centimeters that it would supply, something like that. But that's an arteriole that they can actually detect with the Doppler. So it's a good size. They can actually dissect it.
Okay.
Because what they want with certain reconstructions is they want to take the tissue along with the artery without disconnecting it, so that it really goes well where they implant it.
I know this is probably irrelevant to what you're going to talk about, but in vasodilation, vasoconstriction to the skin flow, where is it occurring in that diagram, in that picture? Is it at all of these levels?
Well, the arteries are the ones that contract, basically, because they have a layer of muscle that responds to
capillaries have no smooth muscle response.
Excuse me?
The capillaries do not have that smooth muscle response.
The capillaries have pericytes, which are, they're not tightly packed on top of the capillary, but they do have smooth muscle actin. So they have some contractility, even at the capillary plexus.
But not a vasoconstrictive response.
But the vasoconstriction occurs in arteries, basically. And the skin is supplied with quite a bit of blood, and that's why when somebody is very scared or whatever, you turn pale, because it's a good reservoir for blood to move into the central organs, your brain, and your heart, of course, your muscles that are going to need it. These are two different magnifications of sections, cross sections of a wound, and this is a wound that is beginning to heal. And at higher mag, you can see here, this is the edge of the regenerating epithelium, which is thicker than the normal epithelium back here. And in the center, this is what's left of the clot. The initial extravasation of blood forms the clot, and the clot is critical for triggering the entire healing process. And then there is this tissue, which is called granulation tissue, that is basically cells that are making matrix, and there is a vast supply of capillaries that are being formed and connecting in the granulation tissue. So this is an actively healing wound. And this one in here is further along. So this one, all the epithelium has covered the gap. These were identical wounds. This one is covered. All the epithelium has regenerated. And in this one, you can see that basement membrane. This is actually very nice, because you can see that membrane, which is a complex mixture of several proteins and collagen of type 4. And this appears to be a reservoir of anti-angiogenic factors, so that the vessels here do not, as I mentioned before, do not cross. And so when an injury occurs, immediately there is extravasation of blood, and clots form, no matter what size they are forming. And the platelets immediately, as the clots are formed, immediately release factors that are present in the in vesicles in all the platelets, and these factors are already pre-made before the wound has a chance to start making its own factors, and they actually are in charge of triggering many of the events that are going to follow in the next few hours. In terms of angiogenesis in the wound, there is going to be angiogenesis and some vasculogenesis. There are going to be vessels formed where there were no other vessels before. And some of them are going to sprout from existing vessels, from damaged vessels. Some of them are not. Some of them are going to form, I will show you some pictures later. Some of them are going to form surrounded by tissue that is dying, and they actually start to form the tubes and assemble in tubes. But once the vessels are being formed, and of course at the beginning there has to be proliferation of endothelial cells, and then there are also signals that are going to signal those endothelial cells to stop proliferating because they have to recommit to form a tube. And all of that is very complex. I guess we know much more about the factors that make endothelial cells proliferate than we know about factors that actually give the signal of to stop proliferating and to actually arrest and re-differentiate, if you want, to actually form a structure. And I find that particular event very interesting because we have some observations that make us believe that we are using some factors that are essentially, that's part of their function would be to stop the cells from proliferating and actually signal them to form the structure. So at the beginning in the wound, there's going to be a lot of vessels formed in the wounds that we use. We use a model, we have several models, but the most common one and the one I'm going to be showing you today is a 3 millimeter excision punch, always done bilaterally in the same area of the skin. And that wound in the back of a mouse takes about 7 days to heal and about 15 days to be difficult to find where it was. But in the first 3 days, there is mostly going to be a very, there is going to be a burst of angiogenic activity. There is going to be a burst of expression of factors acutely. As it was mentioned on Monday, the hypoxia-inducible factors are very important. And they respond to low oxygen, but also they respond to stress conditions in the tissue. But then once these vessels are being formed, they not all are good vessels. They're not all immediately have flow and can feed the tissue. So there is, as the vessels are being formed, there is remodeling that takes place. There are vessels that fall apart immediately because they really cannot mature, or they're just not being anastomosed correctly, and they're not having flow, and then they fall apart. So there is vessel remodeling so that the vessels that are formed are not just like an hemangioma there that doesn't do anything. So it's very tightly regulated that the vessels that are being formed need to be functional, and whatever is not useful, it's taken away. But then as the healing progresses and the wound is completely closed and the tissue is repaired, although the scar is always going to be there, the tissue is going to be slightly different, the excessive vessels that were formed to actually feed this process then, for the most part, get reabsorbed. So all of that happens within, in the mouse model, happens within within 7 days. You can immediately at a few hours, you can see cells starting to come out of the vessels and try to proliferate. And then at the end of 5 or 6 days, you already see less and less vascularization in the wounds. And we have always studied wounds from 24 hours to 15 days, but lately we decided to start looking at wounds at very early times because we suspected that the cytokine that we study, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it, leptin, we suspect that for other reasons, we suspected that it had anti-apoptotic effects and that it may be protecting the cells of the vessels that, so this is the wound. This is where we took off 3 millimeters of skin. And many of the vessels, when we stain these for apoptosis, within 3 hours we see, in normal wounds, we see lots of these vessels dying as well as other cells. This is a specific stain for an endothelial marker. And what we see is, of course, this is just a section, but it's a thick section. It's 14 micrometers. And we see, for example, in this vessel, we see what appears to be cells that are essentially coming out, and not necessarily, this is 1.5 hours, not necessarily these are leukocytes, because we have controls and we inhibit peroxidases, so we are basically staining endothelial cells. And what we see as well is we start to see images where we find endothelial cells that are sort of isolated in the sense that they're not forming part of a vessel. And we think that they come from the damaged vessels. Some of them crawl out of the damaged vessels. And then these cells are probably going to quickly start to proliferate as soon as they settle in a certain spot. And so, for example, this one is sort of spread, but then we see them a little bit more elongated in some spots.
What's your length scale? Can you give us a, like on the right hand panel, what would represent like 20 micrometers?
I apologize, we didn't put this is probably with the 40X, so this is probably what, 10 micrometers, this distance? This is a section across, and not a cross section, but it's within the plane of the wound, and we're in the dermis, and we go and look at these vessels, and we do this at multiple times, but as I say, we're becoming interested in these early points in which the cells that were forming vessels may be either dying or may survive and actually contribute to the formation of blood vessels. That's something we... So in my lab, we have several goals, of course, and one of them is that we really feel that it's not well characterized, the progression of angiogenesis in wounds, and that's one of the things that we are doing. We're studying gene expression and protein expression, as well as vessel counting and so forth, on very early times and very late times, and we are trying to paint a more accurate picture of what happens during wound healing. We are very interested in the cytokine leptin, which is an angiogenic cytokine. You may have heard about it as a regulator of appetite, but it's actually very similar to the IL-6 cytokines, and it has very powerful effects on endothelial cells and in tooth formation for endothelial cells. It is also a healing-promoting cytokine, so you can treat wounds with leptin and they heal faster. And we became interested in wounds precisely because the animals that are deficient in leptin were thought to be healing impaired because of diabetes, but that's not true. They're healing impaired because they lack leptin or because they lack the leptin receptor. So for example, if you have an animal that is a knockout for leptin and you make two wounds, they immediately become ulcers. They're like really poor healers. But you can put on one side the treatment with leptin and on the other side no treatment, and the side that you treat topically with leptin will heal. And we know that leptin is also hypoxia-inducible. It's acutely producing the wounds. We have done extensive work on that. And I'm going to show you lots of data where we compare things with leptin, but the point is not leptin, it's going to be actually how we are quantifying angiogenesis in wounds. So of course we're interested in impaired healing under different conditions and situations. Diabetes is one, and also cigarette smoke is actually a nicotine, and essentially people who smoke are very poor healers. So that we have some models in which we study impaired healing. But we are also interested in developing modalities that may improve angiogenesis in acute or chronic wounds. Not necessarily all skin wounds. Sometimes we think we can affect muscle or even cardiac muscle by developing methods in which we can probably enrich or produce endothelial cells out of either isolated endothelial cells or isolated stem cells. And recently we are doing some very intriguing studies with embryonic stem cells. I am actually one of the few people who is funded by NIH to study human embryonic stem cells, because I George Bush gave us permission to use a few cell lines, and so I have a little bit of funding to study one of those cell lines and how we can drive those cells to differentiate into endothelial cells and form tubes and so forth. So we are interested in trying to develop therapeutic modalities in which you may be able to revascularize a tissue that is chronically, especially chronically, ischemic. So just briefly, leptin, as I said, is a molecule that signals very similar to all the molecules of the IL-6 family. It's a soluble cytokine. It's produced by many cells, not only adipocytes. It is secreted literally by many activated cells, especially during hypoxia conditions. It does regulate the appetite in the hypothalamus. It's one of the regulators, but it also modulates the use of energy in peripheral tissues by modulating proteins that uncouple oxidative phosphorylation in mitochondria.
I just had this comment about cigarette smoking intrigued me. So is it that nicotine is an anti-angiogenic factor, or is there something else that causes blood vessels to shrink? That interferes with the angiogenic factors of angiogenic properties of leptin?
Well, I don't think that that's very well established.
Okay.
And the tobacco companies are not very interested in that either. nicotine has been reported in one paper as being pro-angiogenic. But the fact of the matter is that it depends who does it and how you do it. Nicotine, we have exposed animals just to nicotine for 7 days, and then you wound those animals, and their healing is severely impaired. And the blood flow around the wound, which we measure with Doppler, is also severely impaired. My guess is that it's just not people have not paid too much attention, but it's a very costly effect of cigarettes, because many people who have surgery, they have to leave the hospital with an open wound if they are smokers, and then they have to have a nurse go and care for their wounds and so forth. And most of the plastic surgeons nowadays have a policy of not doing elective surgery on smokers because of the problems they have with healing. So it is a very important effect, but I think that the cigarette companies don't want another
reason for not smoking.
Yeah, because the cost is very, very high. I mean, the states could probably sue them again or something.
But is a nicotine vasoconstrictor, direct vasoconstrictor of blood capillaries? No, maybe that's related to that.
Yeah, but that's,
that's
nicotine is just one, yes, but it is a vasoactive molecule, but nicotine is just one of hundreds of thousands of chemicals. I mean, the list of chemicals in cigarette smoke is very, very large. And we just tested nicotine because we didn't have the smoking machine to put the mice in, but nicotine, just by exposing animals to nicotine, after a few days, their healing is impaired.
When you're exposing them to the nicotine, were the levels comparable to what you could see in a single cigarette or a packed cigarette? Like, how much?
I don't recall. We used certain doses that are pretty much what I don't recall. Because we did this for a proposal, but Philip Morris didn't like it. Yeah, they did it, and they said, you know, the patients, what if they are impaired when they go to surgery? They can stop smoking before surgery. I mean, this is actually entertaining, but...
I didn't mean to take you off.
No, but it's an important thing, and not many people pay attention to it, unfortunately. So leptin is angiogenic and hypoxia-inducible, and this has been the work that I and some of my collaborators have done in the last few years, and this is why we are interested in wounds and in angiogenesis together. This image is an image of some endothelial cells, human endothelial cells, exposed to leptin, and this circle that they form is actually a very reproducible type of a structure that they will form. And I'm hoping at the end, I'll have a few minutes to discuss that, because I think this is something that maybe one of you could have good ideas, and I've been very intrigued about this effect on leptin. So we use several experimental approaches. We have very well-defined models, very reproducible. We image the wounds in vivo with laser Doppler, and we have a few other imagers. But basically, we image the flow around the wound, and you know, we can also take pictures, macroscopic pictures of the wounds. And that's what we do when the animals are alive. And they and then when after we sacrifice the animals and we obtain the tissue, we actually can study gene expression in the periphery of the wound and protein content and expression. We do a lot of histology and immunohistochemistry to identify different things that are there. And lately, you know, I have always liked very much to measure things. And I really wanted to have the means of
of saying how many vessels are here, what is the diameter of these vessels, and so forth. So we embarked in a very difficult set of experiments in which we create casts, silicone casts of the entire vasculature of the animal. And when we are successful to get to the skin, which is the first place where there is basic constriction, and we can take the entire wound, we punch it to make the wound, and then we do a larger punch, concentric, so we always have the same size. We create these molds of tissue where all the vessels have a polymer, and that polymer has a radiopaque, it has like metal in there. I think they do it with automotive paint or something. Then a few institutions have micro CT scanners where they can go and take an X-ray we do 8 millimeter punches out of a 3 millimeter wound, and then the people with whom we collaborate every 6 micrometers, they take an image in both directions, and then with their software, they reconstitute all of this into a 3D image. But that's the image is not the most important part, is the data that they generate, in which we can now measure the volume of the vessels, the connectivity of the vessels, etc. So this has been very difficult because we have a very poor rate of success with good casts, but we're getting better.
Mm-hmm. Could you comment on the dye you're using to visualize the vessels, and also how and when you administer it for your micro CT analysis?
So this is post-mortem. We take an animal and we perfuse the entire vasculature with a polymer, and then as it polymerizes, this silicone leaves inside. The silicone is mixed with the paint that has metal in it, and that's what the CT is, the X-rays are going to pick up. So that's how it's done. And then we also we started very innocently in a project in which we just wanted to do CAM assays. We wanted to measure angiogenesis in certain factors and check that our batches were the same. So, but something very nice derived from that. So we do the conventional morphometry, and we did this for a long time, in which we take cross-sections of the wounds, and we can measure distances between the borders. We do all of these with just simple imaging programs where we can go and say, well, what is the distance between the borders, and what is the area of the granulation tissue, and so forth. And so we have done extensive conventional morphometry, and as long as our wounds are consistent, our numbers tend to be quite consistent as well and reproducible. This is a picture of some of those casts. And so the wound has been punched out, and as you can see, this is these are two 24-hour wounds, and you can see the one that the animal we treated with leptin has much more vessels already forming. But you can see how powerful this effect is in and around the wound. You can literally see how vessels are growing into it and around it, and you're going to see a little bit more in detail later. So these are two examples of that technique, in which we have, it's just the polymer is blue, but we are interested in it because it's radiopaque.
In the wound, after the wound is made, is that all filled with plasma or some kind?
Yeah, there is a clot and then a provisional matrix there, yes. And then immediately, very quickly, in a few hours, there is a monolayer of keratinocytes. The first thing they do is they cover, and then the complete epithelium is formed. But at first, within hours, a wound is covered by a monolayer of keratinocytes, actually. So we, doing these histological sections, we can stain with antibodies for different markers of endothelium, and we have actually been able to count the vessels, and we characterize our response to leptin, and we take the tissue and we look at genes that are being expressed during the process, for example, I think this is a 6-hour, I think it is a 6-hour or the one next. These are 3 and 6 hours in which, this is actually interesting because at 3 hours, when we look at a battery of about 40 different genes, but these are genes that are important for angiogenesis, and some of them are markers or are surface receptors for endothelial cells. So they sort of tell us the endothelium in there. So at 1.5 hours, there is signal of endothelium in terms of RNA in the wounds. But in the control wounds that we don't treat, by 6 hours, there is actually less than in the normal skin. So this is a reduction relative to normal skin. So we know how much the normal skin expresses these genes, and we know that it actually goes down. And we think this is part of that apoptosis, massive apoptosis that happens very quickly. And with leptin, we actually are able to prevent that. And we think that that's part of why it's so powerful as a pharmacological agent, because we may jumpstart the wound by preventing that some of the cells that are there to die.
So if you look at VEGF in that array?
Yes, of course. About several isoforms as well. And actually, there is something about hypoxia-inducible genes which go much faster with leptin. So we decided to do this computer tomography because, as you can see in here, this is a 3D reconstruction, and sometimes you can play the little movie and rotate them. But this is actually part of the image that the machine will give us after it reconstructs the wound. But they also give us values that are actually very important for us. They can tell us the entire volume of the sample, and then of that volume, what percentage is vessels, and then how connected they are, and what is the average diameter of the vessels, and what is the range of that diameter, and so forth. So we're obtaining very interesting information out of these. These are difficult experiments because not only technically for us it's difficult to make this cast, but it is expensive to do these micro CTs, and takes about 3 days to run one of these samples at the resolution of 6 micrometers. So,
have you digested the?
No. You take them. We put it in glycerol and we make it more transparent so we can take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea here is the tissue is just fixed and preserved in glycerol.
So your micro CT data is in 3D.
Yeah, this would be, if I had put the little movie thingy, you could actually rotate it and look at it. Because it's a 3D reconstruction of many, many slices that they did every 6 micrometers.
Well, what's the advantage of that over using, so that this is like, an object is like 2 millimeters or something like that, or 3 millimeters? Is that how large the object is? I guess what I wanted to ask is why not just use some kind of a scanning confocal microscope and reconstruct at 1 micrometer resolution or something?
Well, because with a scanning, of course, thought of that a long time ago before we got into this, but you can't really do an area this big with fluorescence unless you have these lasers and cameras that are, but even those are not the best. And also, you can't really do more than a few 100 micrometers. I mean,
yeah,
you can't.
That's why I was asking how big is the.
This is a full thickness, so it's entire. So it's about 2 millimeters thick, and it's 8 millimeters. So we wanted to have the entire wound. We tried dissecting little areas and doing the confocal, but this way we get a complete picture of the wound. So this is one of the samples that we send out for the normal vasculature, and you're just looking at it from the bottom of the skin, and of course we do several of those to have our normal values. This is a 72-hour set of samples, and as you can see, in this area where the wound existed, of course there is now a provisional matrix and all of that, but the vessels are starting to grow. And look, I don't know if you can appreciate how many, what complex network of vessels is exactly around the wound. But it is really amazing how many vessels are there, and those are actually connected because we were able to perfuse them.
I'm not understanding where the leptin is. Is this topical application? Is this a,
These are topical applications that we do at the time of wounding. We only do one application, and that triggers this whole series of things. We keep the model as simple as possible.
Yes.
We do one treatment at the moment of wounding, and perhaps the whole effect is because we are preventing some apoptosis there. It protects endothelial cells, and that's why we jump started. It doesn't hypervascularize. At the end of the day, we know that the vessels in the wound knows how many vessels it wants, and it reaches a maximum, and then it goes down. So we have compared the number of vessels, and we know that with leptin, we get it faster, but we don't get more. Eventually, the untreated wound will catch up. And this is a detail of that of one of these borders, and just because I wanted you to see the complexity of all these vessels that are growing, and some of them are growing already in the matrix. Of course, you can't see the matrix, but they're already growing in the tissue that's been generated underneath the wound. Part of all of this is the granulation tissue that I mentioned, and here's an example of a set of experiments where we took the samples and they were sent for micro-CT and so forth, and we took the normal skin and then compared it to saline-treated wounds, or the control wounds, at 24 hours compared to the leptin at 24 hours. Leptin reaches the stage of 72 hours in the control wound very early by 24 hours. And then later on, the wounds start to regress.
One more. You're doing a lot of quantification. Are you also quantifying tortuosity of the vessels?
Yes, we are. And we're quantifying a lot of parameters. I just didn't want to go into all the parameters, but we have connectivity and
okay.
Tortuosity, we do it with the cams. I'll show you something. But
yeah.
But in here, we have average diameter, and we have total length of the vasculature, and we have connectivity and so forth. And this is another reconstruction. You can see the hole in the middle of the, this is probably a 24-hour, this is probably a 72-hour, in which this usually play like a little movie, but that's the micro-CT. And so it's becoming very helpful for us. It's taken a long time because our colleagues at UCLA in the School of Dentistry that started doing this with us basically gave up because it takes a long time to do mostly the analysis, I think. It takes about 76 hours to analyze. I think the scan takes 4 hours, but then the analysis takes so long. But the company that makes these micro-CT scanners is doing it for us at a very reasonable price now. So we did some here at UCLA, but I couldn't afford the cost that UCLA wanted to charge me for it. So as I was saying, the other way we are doing quantitative studies is using the correlato membrane of the coil. And this, it's a very old assay in which investigators have tested angiogenesis. I guess there are a few novelty parts of what we do, but basically this correlato membrane, and I'm sure you heard Charlie went on to the avian embryo in good detail, but this, imagine it as the placenta, the way the egg is going to get oxygen. So it's on an air interface, and what we have done, most people do these androgenic assays inside the egg, so they make a little window in the egg. And but Helena Sage in Washington developed in her lab. They developed this assay in which you can put a quail embryo into a plate at a certain stage, and it survives. About 80% of them survive, and we take them from embryonic day 3 all the way to embryonic 14, I think, is the maximum we have done. But we usually do our assays between day 7 and day 10, where we actually, so this is in the air interface, and then we place the factors that we want to test on this membrane, and then we can dissect that membrane and image it, and it's actually a really, a very good way of for us to assess angiogenesis. So we wanted to do it for very, very simple and pedestrian things, reasons, but and we basically went on with the model that was described in the literature from Helena's lab, in which they describe this six-well plate thing, and they also describe the mathematical analysis, and they did a few things in, I guess you can do them with ImageJ. They developed a little program that they put in MATLAB. But the problem was that they will not give it to anyone. So so that triggered the fact that I wanted to do the quantitation, and I was upset because they, how can you do it if you don't get the reagent, which is the program in this case. So, and they were measuring only the fractal dimension and the grid intersection as measures of vessel density and of branching. At CEDARS there is a new group that does only imaging, and they're all physicists, and they have computer programming people, and taking advantage of the collaboration I could do with them, we actually decided to go ahead and see if they could help us measure different parameters, and we ended up measuring many more parameters than the original paper. And this is how it's done. It's just a little tricky how you open the egg, but you put them in little plates, and then the embryos develop, and it's actually a very good way of doing lots of experiments. And this is one of our manuscripts that is it was sent back with revisions, in which we did this collaboration with Daniel Farkas, and Yitzi is a very talented computer programming imaging person that worked with Dan Farkas. Is actually the one that came up with all the ideas on how to do this. And so many of the things that he decided he could measure with this, he did it with a node, with not structural maps. And basically what he did is with the images that we take of these camps, so basically he defined the nodes like this. So the end nodes were like pixels that only have one pixel next to it, right? So this is the end node. So what will this give us? This will give us the number of branches. So we have the end nodes that gave us the terminal branches. then the second type of node is the one where a pixel has two neighbors. And that one will give us the length, because you put all those pixels together. Of course, these images are skeletonized, and I'll show you how. But so we can actually measure the length and the number of terminal branches. And then he defined another one that he called the Fulcation node. And so when you have a pixel that is actually neighbored by three pixels, well, that is where it's a bifurcation. But sometimes the furcation is not bi, it's like there may be more. So you have a pixel, and it's neighbored by four pixels, so you have a more complex ramification of the vessel. So that was in part what we measured. The other thing that we measured was the tortuosity, because leptin in particular is very, it's very obvious, even to the naked eye, that the vessels that are formed initially are very tortuous. So he helped us with the tortuosity, and we still measure the fractal dimension and grid intersection that was measured in the previous paper. And so he put all of these in MATLAB, and there is a little program where where we feed the images and get all these values. this is part of his manuscript where the image is a skeletonized, and then the algorithm things he put in there will do the node structure map, and then the measurements can be derived from there, and then of course from just the image that has not been skeletonized, we can measure the diameter of the vessels, and then he also decided to measure tortuosity by this cork thing, in which he measures from the point of flotation to the end node, and it will give us a measurement of tortuosity. Originally, what I thought he was going to do is that he was going to put a straight line over a vessel that is tortuous, and then look at the points where it cuts. But actually, he set up for that, and it appears to be working, because we get very clear results when we obviously see the vessels more tortuous. And this one didn't show, but so this one is the actual fractal image, but it just didn't show. And this is where the nodes are. And this one is the diameter map. And I can, you know, share this data if anybody is interested. This is a particular experiment that we did just to show you the wealth of information we can get from a single image. So we do the CAM, and then we dissect it and put it in a cover slip, take an image, a digital image, and then the program will take that image and do all the modifications it has to do to the image. And so we can measure relative branching and complexity. This, I think, is done, this is the fractal dimensions. And the grid intersection is done vertical and horizontal, and for the most part, we get similar numbers. And the tortuosity in this case is very similar in all the different treatments. This was something else we were doing. And we have the average vessel diameter, and we also measure the total vessel length. So in this case, for example, we have the not treated cams are different in terms of branching and in terms of length to some of the cams that were treated with some of these constructs that of an angiogenic factor that the colleague was making. So by just feeding one image, we are able to generate quantitative parameters that tell us a little bit more about what is going on in there, and we can actually have measurements. We measured the effects of leptin. We measured the effects of antibodies to leptin. We have used chicken avian leptin and antibodies to avian leptin, and we have been able to generate enough data that we are very comfortable with the way this quantitative method is working, and it's actually allowing us to study the regulation of vessel formation by leptin. This image that I promised you I would go back to, it's very important, not only because it's pretty, and it was taken by chance also. That one came out by chance. But what we observed when we treated endothelial cells in two dimensions So these were cells that were plated very sparse, and then we treat them or not with leptin. This was an assay we were developing, and we would count only the nuclei, and then we look at the red and see how many of them are actually making structure. And what we realized very quickly is that every time we would use, for example, VEGF as a positive control, and the cells do move and organize actually in different clusters with different angiogenic factors. But with leptin, it was very reproducible. that when we were treating the cells with leptin, we would get the cells to organize and then enclose a circle. And we have seen this over and over and over, especially with microvascular endothelial cells. So whereas the cells that are treated with where cells that are being treated with other angiogenic factors basically immediately elongate and move very quickly, so they become elongated and you can and then eventually form clusters, very nice clusters that then can become tubes. Indeed, this is a two-dimensional assay. But they actually try to organize almost in a tube. with leptin, we saw that the formation of enclosed circle by many cells was repetitive. And then when we do this in three-dimensional gels, we also see that leptin is very potent in allowing the endothelial cells to assemble in actual tubes that have a lumen inside. We are now doing the same similar things with sort of like what was presented on Monday. They do these explants. We do embryo bodies of embryonic stem cells, and we stimulate them to form blood vessels, and then we can go and look in discovery sleep at the vessels that are being formed, and we use positive controls. We use erythropoietin and BGF and so forth, but with leptin, there are networks that are very complex. Many of them are immature networks in the sense that they have the what's called the chicken wire, so they're not, you know, branches. But it's a very fast effect of leptin to enclose these circles. So what I thought the first time I saw this is this could be important because it could be, and I'm not saying leptin does everything. But it's actually a very redundant signal that the leptin gives. There are other molecules that are very efficient at giving the same signal. But what I thought is that this could be very important because it may be telling us how the cells actually need to stop and form a tube. You need to leave a center that's hollow and organized. And so when we were doing this, one of the things that I first thought is that if you have a cell that's sort of moving very fast, and then for the cell to become that type of, a few cells to become that type of formation, what it needs to happen is the cell is moving, but what I thought may be happening, and I had some drawings, but I couldn't have, what I thought is that if, let's say the cell is moving like this, and for this cell to become a circle, so it's coming from here, and it's going to enclose a circle with some neighbors here. So it moves, the leading edge moves, but then something, most likely a complex biochemical event, that has to do probably with the matrix and the receptors on the cell, will not allow it to continue on this leading edge. And so what I thought that may be happening is that then the neighbors of this region that advance first are the ones that will advance. But as they advance, the same thing happens. They are not allowed to advance again. And then this part will advance and so forth. And the biological event, of course, I cannot tell you how it happens. I have some ideas, but I cannot tell you how it happens. But the fact that this, and this is very rapid. We can actually observe this within an hour after treating cells in cover sleeves. But the formation of these enclosed circles is clearly different than just aggregation of cells or formation of tubes. And I think it's a very interesting thing that may be modeled in some way to try to explain how these circles are.
Yeah, is there a dose response for this effect of
yes.
Leptin?
Leptin has a bell-shaped yes. Leptin is like any other molecule that has homodimerization of receptors. Leptin has a bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. So there are high doses that actually inhibit them, and we actually have a dose response series of experiments in this system of two-dimensional, and we know the dose, we know that the optimal dose is probably in the low nanomolar range.
Nanomolar.
One nanomolar to high picomolar.
And does it bind to the extracellular matrix also, non-specifically? I mean, I'm just thinking that maybe that's a local concentration.
So leptin does not, is not like VGF and other factors that binds heparin, try that. Whether the matrix is a reservoir for it or not, I cannot tell you. It is very sticky. Actually, many people don't know this, and they go and buy leptin, and they, you know, the second time they use it, it doesn't work because it's very sticky, sticks to plastic. It's a nightmare. But so it probably has some type of.
They may buy into other guys. I mean, you know, heparin sulfur is not the only thing.
No, I know, but that's the one that was logical at first that we put it through a column. So we don't know whether it binds to the matrix, but that's obviously very likely. We know that the cells express receptor like Christmas trees. I mean, they have a lot. The endothelial cells have very abundant full length leptin receptors.
You must be binding to the plastic in that system, right?
Yes. And then of course I just didn't want to not mention my colleague Ting-Yu Chang from the School of Dentistry and our collaborators at CEDARS who do the imaging and also do the. Okay. So thank you very much.